Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCB 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 105.0 AM Palm Springs.
We're back in the House of Mystery, and today is joining us is two mystery guys. We've got Michael Butterfield and Gregory Ash.
Thank you for having me.
That went well. Well, I've been so now, Greg. You haven't been around for a while. You've been busy. I asked you this before. What is all the new books?
Boy, I know. Well, this is like the one positive side for me, at least, of the pandemic is I've had all this time indoors and chained to my desk. Mm-hmm. So I've just been writing, and it all pays off eventually, I guess. You know, it's been such a weird year. You know, I teach high school and we were virtual for so long, and then had, you know, our summer vacation in the middle of all that you know, it's just been a lot of time that I've been, so anyway, it's been good. It's been productive. The only, like I said, the only good part of this whole pandemic.
Has it been easier for you to write during this, or is it harder because of stress? Or
I think it's been, you know, maybe up and down, like easier at some points because I can just devote more energy, like mental energy to it. Like I'm not grading. I'm not, you know, getting up and working a full day. So that part's been easier. But, you know, there's the pandemic has brought its own, you know, stressors. So maybe up and down.
You must feel out of place, but like when you're, I mean, teaching class, how does that go? Like, it's not a full day now, right?
So we are, yeah, we have everybody back in the building, and there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's really something. You know, I live in a real conservative part of the world, and I teach in a real conservative part of my area, so it's kind of a double whammy, and they are convinced that this is the best thing for everybody. Just to have the kids back, and if they had their way, it would be without masks and without social distancing. So at least we, you know, won that battle.
But yeah, yeah.
Well, what do you think that is, Bud? Why is it that, I mean, because isn't it just common sense? Like the medical community just says, well, you know, it comes from our mouth. It comes from moisture.
Right.
If we wear a mask, we can't pass it on, or we got or very little chance of it. It makes it better. So what's the big deal?
Yeah, I'd be curious to hear what, you know, both of you think about this as well. But what I seem to see is that it's almost, you know, there are people that are just the science deniers, right? And they just are convinced that this is all,
it's all fake. You know,
it's a fake, it's a hoax, or it's a scheme to take over the world. But then I think probably the larger issue in my community is just that people, their priorities are skewed. You know, like we have had parents protesting our superintendent, our county commissioner, or county executive, because really, they may not go so far as to say they don't believe the science, but they're more worried about their kid not being able to play sports. You know what I mean? So it's, I think it's really more an issue of, I don't know, what have you guys seen, or what do you think?
That's what I see in here in Arizona, where, you know, the governor wouldn't do anything and for a long time refused to let anybody do anything. And then the mayors started putting up some mask ordinances. And we have science deniers here. Apparently there's a lot of people who don't understand that their nose and their mouth are connected to their lungs. Not sure if they didn't pay attention during anatomy class or, but there's also, I think, you know, there's just people who they deny it's real. Then there's people who they just don't understand how serious it is.
Right.
And I think that's what a lot of the problem comes from. And you have people that, well, I call them nosers, the people who wear their masks below their nose.
Yeah.
And they don't understand that that's just as bad as not wearing a mask. But I think a lot of it, especially at this stage, is what they call COVID fatigue, where people are just sick of it and they think, oh, there's a vaccine coming and it'll be better soon, so I don't really have to worry about it. And especially I have people in my family and friends who are teachers as well, and it's very difficult here because they can't seem to get any clear leadership and any, you know, reinforcement of what needs to be done.
Yeah, that sounds real familiar.
Yeah, it's better up in Canada in the sense of the deniers. There are some around, but they certainly don't have the platform that they do in the States.
Al, last time I talked to you, it was pretty contained in your area. Like, it still is.
We moved up a tier because in Toronto, I guess it got bad too with the second wave, and they're closed down. But in the West, we went, like I said, we got like, I think we had 45 new cases yesterday.
Wow.
And that put us on to mask mandatory.
We would gladly have that.
Yeah, seriously.
I know. You know, they're all freaking out here. You know, she breaks in and all the TV channels, the health officer here, and she's like, well, the province has to go on mandatory masks. We had 45 new cases yesterday.
Wow.
And we've had 7,000 since the pandemic started. And you're thinking, wow, geez, that's a day.
Yeah, we're having 4,500 a day.
Holy cow.
Yeah. So it's contained as compared when we compare it to you guys, but up here the mentality is to be like Australia, where you're having all these 0 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not judging us against you. They're judging us against Australia or New Zealand, maybe the UK. So which we're beating, but you know. So I think they think 45 is huge, and it's laughable when you look at what the States is doing.
Yeah,
but I haven't seen many deniers. There's been a few people that I don't know. Up here, it reminds me of the old days where you get someone comes in and they kind of scream and then they leave, you know. But you don't have too many of them. You see,
you don't have the holes there. No, we call them mask holes.
No, they had the big mask anti-mask rally in Vancouver, which is the big city, and I guess about 50 people showed up.
Wow.
This is a city of, like, you know, 3 million people, so you're not really getting a whole lot of attention.
Right.
Like, it's not really catching on. like, that's a pretty small number, right?
Yeah.
So I just don't, it's not really that. But the fatigue is definitely there. I think people are kind of tired of it.
Yeah.
Now, I want to ask you, Gregory, does COVID start to influence how you think about plot at all? Do you start thinking about writing in the COVID universe? Because I noticed that there's a lot of fiction. There's an attempt to sort of avoid that and stay in our previous world.
I know. I don't know what to do. So the books that I've been working on are all about 2 years in the past chronologically. So I haven't had to answer that question for my own stuff yet. But I don't know what I'm going to do about that, because I think people are – they kind of want to pretend it didn't happen, even if they're, you know, doing everything they can to mitigate and all those things.
Yeah. They want the escape of it.
Yeah. I do find myself, like, when I've been revising, I'll be like, now, wait a minute, that person doesn't have a mask on. You know, I have to remind myself, this wasn't how we always lived.
Yeah, do you, I don't know about you guys, but I'm, like, watching some movie from Humphrey Bogart from, like, 1940s or something, and all of a sudden I'm like, they're standing too close to
each other. Yeah, back up, yeah.
Well, you know, I did an interview this week earlier, and I had an interesting comment from someone. What was his name? His name was Thornton.
Michael. It was Thornton. Marshall. Yeah,
Marshall Thornton. Yeah. You know, and he had an interesting comment about how there's been, if you look back at Spanish flu, like the last big one, there's not a whole lot of material from there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I wonder if it's going to be the same way. I wonder if the writers at the time avoided writing it about it. For the same reason that people are doing it now, maybe.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. They felt the same way.
You don't want to be reminded of it. You want to have an escape and place where you can remember what it used to be like.
Right.
Because there isn't a whole lot. I can't think of any, actually, myself. But you're more of a fiction guy than I am.
If most of the fiction people read is meant to be escapist, I think there's something maybe a little too real about this pandemic. I think people enjoy reading, you know, maybe a techno thriller about a possible pandemic or
kind
of those apocalyptic films. But I think this may strike, I don't know. That's just kind of my gut feeling, is it may strike a little too close to home.
Well, especially when you write, you know, mystery stuff where you have to deal with law enforcement or anything like that. You know, if you're writing a book where you're hoping it's going to be made into a movie, then maybe, you want to write it to be, you know, where everybody's wearing masks so then it can actually be filmed or something. But if you're, you know, just trying to write some fiction for somebody to escape into, I know I've been watching a lot of really old movies. Like, I don't think I even need a color TV anymore right now. But there's some kind of escapism in that too. And then also watching things that came in the years after the Spanish flu, like, oh, look, they got through it, you know, like maybe we can too.
Yeah. But I think they were probably a little bit more, I look at the times back then, as more, obedience, not the word, but a little bit more,
responsible.
Yeah, see, I don't have the word. Come on, Greg, you're
the star. Maybe, like, I think there's certainly a degree of, like, a better sense of community and, like, you know, like, kind of your
civic responsibility.
Yeah.
Well, I think that, you know, if the government says, so we've got this, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, people just jump on it. But now they question, and now they don't trust, and now they think, oh, they're lying to us.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas I don't get that sense back during World War One and Two and all this.
No, I agree.
You know what I mean? I get more of a, I don't want to say teamwork, but there was just more of a, oh, if your doctor says that, you do it. Or but now it's like, well, I don't know, you know, they could be lying.
Maybe more trust in, like, authority figures or something like that.
I guess so. And I think that's a big difference.
Yeah.
Maybe, and you know, I don't mean to jump in here, but I think maybe it's not just more trust, but it's more respect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't think there's a lot of respect for government agencies, and especially when you have a government that isn't, you know, being responsible and being a good role model.
But that was going on before Trump, because even when you had Obama in, there was a lot of people not showing respect toward him.
Yeah, well, so it's even if colliding with the anti-vaccine stuff and
exactly
all this anti-science, this whole,
and for the most part, that I think the unfortunate thing is most of them, it's just all sort of, it's all fiction.
Yeah,
you know what I mean. It's not, it's not like they're scientists or they're people studying to be a doctor and they have some sort of, they're in the business, but they still tell you what you can and can't do, right? Like there's. It's weird. It's just a lack of respect for expertise. Mm-hmm.
Definitely that. And I think, you know, there's this, you know, and it comes, I think it comes from a lot of sources, you know, like a lot of that is, I think comes maybe from elements that push back against what they perceive as academia or intelligentsia. But I think, you know, on the academic side, we've perpetrated some of that too. You know, there's, you know, deconstructionism and kind of the push to overturn like a lot of those shared expectations about society, about, you know, whatever you want to pick, gender, sexuality, religion, like those, you know, you kind of pay the price for them, right? Because when you challenge things, then everything's up to be challenged. And so I think, you know, on both sides, even though those, I would argue that destabilizing a lot of those constructs was really important. You know, there's always a cost.
Yeah.
And that's probably right. It's probably something that's going to take time.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll see, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, at the Supreme Court, it's been
stopping
the, you know, the church assemblies, hey?
Yeah.
So like when you know, when New York there in Cuomo put on a restriction, then they blocked that order.
Yeah.
So if you, well, that's because you have Amy Coney Barrett on there and
doing
exactly what she was put there to do.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
So that's going to be kind of, you know, in a circle. It's going to be just running around.
Well, remember when George W. Bush tried to appoint that woman to the Supreme Court? I can't remember exactly what her position was, but the running joke was that she was basically his cleaning lady. And people were talking about how unqualified she was. And Amy Coney Barrett was a judge for, like, what, 3 years before she went up there? And now she's making these kinds of decisions for the entire country. And that's a problem in and of itself. But what you were saying, Gregory, about, you know, it's, you start to push the boundaries on things that need to be pushed against, and then it kind of gives people either gives the impression that you should do it with everything, or you sort of get some blowback from the people who don't like what you were doing in the first place. I mean, just the fact that the fiction you write in and of itself is an example of that.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, I don't share my work with anybody, you know, really at work or with my students, because, you know, it is such a conservative part of the world that, you know, although a lot of the world has changed for the better, you know, there's these little dark corners that they are what they are, you know.
Mm. So now what have you been writing now? I see this one book called A Friend in the Dark. Now that sounds very interesting.
That one was, that was a really fun project. I co-wrote that with C.S. Poe, who's another mystery writer. So what was really fun about that, but also challenging, is we literally wrote the entire thing together. We had a Google Doc that we were both on at the same time and kind of wrote through every word. It was hard. So that's like a contemporary mystery series that's going on, and the next one's going to come out early 2021. And so that's one. And then the other project that I've got going on is this series about a wildlife veterinarian and a con man. It's set in Utah, set in the Intermountain West.
Well, that's kind of interesting. When you write with someone else in fiction, so you guys kind of work on it together at the same time, hey?
That's the first time I've done that. That was a new experience, and it was, you know, like the challenges were not at the level of plot or content, really. They were more at the level of just the logistics of execution. You know, it just took so much time for both of us to be there together writing this. But like the actual content, everything worked pretty smoothly for us.
Wow. I was going to say, because I've never done it quite that way. And when I've written with other crime authors, like Peter Vronsky and stuff, you kind of do your own stuff.
Well, yeah. So tell me, how have you done it? What have you guys done?
Well, for me, I've worked with Peter and some of the other. But you see, the thing is, for me, I looked at them as being the master.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've written tons of books. They've got, you know,
well, especially Peter.
Yeah, he's got a doctorate. He's got all this stuff. So for me, I was his cleaning lady. Well, you know what I mean. I mean, I was looking to him for the direction. I wasn't giving the direction. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And when you said you wrote your own parts, like, did you have chapters that you were kind of responsible for, or what did you? How did
you sort of. He sort of would. We would just sort of. Yeah. I would have things I would write about, and then he would tell me what I did wrong. And no, we spent, or I remember we spent a couple hours and at a time, and he would talk a lot and direct me. How's that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
that's good. That's
yeah,
good.
It's that's good. It, but yeah. It's kind of, it was very elusive trying to get an actual answer. Do you know, like I could do something and then he would speak for 2 hours, but I wouldn't get like the, so is it good? Is it bad? Or anything like that. He would always say, people like your reading. So I knew then that I wasn't good enough. You know what I mean? Like I had to get better, but that was his way of doing it.
Well, you could learn from worse.
Oh, God, no, and I'm not, and I look at it, this is years ago, and I look back and I kind of think, well, it was good for me at the time. It was frustrating, but it was really good for me, because then you keep on trying to achieve something better, and that rather than thinking you've done it great,
right.
You know what I mean? It was good, it was a good thing, but that's what I couldn't imagine, sitting and writing with someone at the same time. But I think I'm different now, and I've got a little bit more experience now, so it might be easier for me.
Well, and maybe just the nature of, well, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It also could have just been the relationship that was in place, the way you described it, you know, like that he had a lot more experience and that you kind of went in. Because I mean, Carol, that C.S. Poe, does have more experience than I do, but we're pretty similar in terms of where we're at in our careers. And so I think we both felt pretty comfortable going into it as, you know, co-writers, as equals on that. I hope she's not doing an interview right now saying the opposite.
Oh my God. Yeah, she was on the other line. She was on earlier.
She said, I took Greg under my wing. He needed some guidance. You know?
She said, oh my God, I've never worked with such an amateur. My God. You know, thank God for Grammarly.
That's right.
No, it was different. Plus the publisher got me together with Peter, and that was how that started. So there was a reason for it. It's different, but it's a different sort of thing, I think, in nonfiction.
Is it something you do again? Would you ever seek that out?
Yes and no. Mm-hmm. I would be glad to work with him, but it would be different now. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. Well, you have a different place. You're a different place now.
Yeah, and so exactly. It would be different, but I don't think there's a need for him to work with me, right? Like, he's not looking to work. Oh, my God, I want to work with, you know.
Not trying to add to his CV with your credit there.
Yeah, he's not, you know what I mean. There might be someone that you really like the way they write and you'd love to work with them or whatever, but I don't think that's in the cards.
That makes a lot of sense.
You know, but that's okay with, I'm okay with that, because it is what it is. Like, he is who he is. He's been doing this since the 60s.
Right.
I was born in the 60s. Right?
Well, now you're the master, Al. You've been doing that with me. You know, you've been helping me over the last few years. So.
Well, yeah, I think that's sort of how it goes. You know, you pay it forward. Like, he was doing it for something. Because you do get something out of helping someone else that's coming along, right?
Yeah.
You know, you get something out of everything you do, I think. And so if there's someone that's a newer writer, I've done that with Mike Brown too, with his new book. And you spend time with him and say, well, you know, this is what I do, or don't worry about this or that. You just sort of pick up things from doing it and you pass it on, and then hopefully they'll do the same when they've got someone. But I certainly don't put myself in the Peter Vronsky category. You know, he's
Michael, is that something, have you done some co-writing as well, or just when you just mentioned that, what were you referring to?
Well, you know, I did some writing for some true crime magazines that Al sort of hooked me up with.
Gotcha.
And we're talking about doing something now with this Zodiac book.
Yes.
He's going to be my co-guy for the Zodiac interviews.
That's awesome.
So,
but I did do, I've done some collaborating over the years, largely on things like screenplays and things like that.
Oh, cool.
Little, little different.
Yeah. But
I did do, collaborated with Mike Kelleher, who's a true crime writer, wrote a book about the Zodiac and some other things. And that was an interesting experience because we had a publisher and we were trying to, you know, a deadline and certain rules and guidelines and things like that. And it is different because, you know, one of the reasons I started writing myself, I used to be involved in theater and other things, but I got kind of fed up with the fact that you know, you have to depend on other people so much. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you're a writer, you know, if something doesn't get done, it's your fault.
Right.
I started gravitating towards that. And then once you're used to doing that, then introducing someone else into it is different and sometimes difficult. But Mike and I had talked a lot about things and we were kind of on the same page about everything. Plus it was a short essay, so it was a little bit to get through it. But I like the collaborative process, but it's all about who you do it with, you know, and
agreed.
And yeah. how much you know them and if you're on the same page.
Yeah.
Well, I think, yeah. So I think it's how you choose that. I mean, so Greg, when you do a collaboration, like, see, how do you choose? Like, how do you just guys decide, oh, let's do this book?
Yeah, what happened was I'd read several of Carol's books before I met her in person, and I really liked them. And, you know, that was a big deal for me because I write in a genre where there's just a real wide range of quality. And I really liked her stuff and I wanted to, you know, meet her in person. So I was at a convention and I met her and we were, you know, getting drinks at the bar and just kind of talking, getting to know each other. And we kind of broached the subject tentatively, and then a couple months later, I had an idea. She tends to write stories that are set in New York City, not exclusively, but she has quite a few there, and I had an idea for a mystery taking place in New York City, and I thought I would run it past her, so I did, and, you know, it just, she said that she, kind of ideas started sparking, and to me, that was a good sign, you know, like, when you're both excited about the idea. You know, I didn't want to rope someone in that was just kind of lukewarm about the concept. And so to me, that was a good sign that we were a good fit for each other, that, you know, she connected with the same parts of the idea that I was excited about. And we kind of built some characters out around the idea. So that's how it worked for us. Now, you know, the next book, we've written a second one that hasn't come out yet. That was a lot easier because it's a sequel, you know? So like at that point, it was just more about, well, what's the next case they're going to solve? And a lot of the pieces were already in place for that.
Mm-hmm. What's the important part of fiction writing? Like, what do you think is the most important or the key thing? And what do you look for when you say you read other people's books that are in fiction and you're going to go, wow, that one's great. I really liked her books.
Yeah.
What is it that is the key thing that makes you go, wow, this is great?
Gosh, that's talk about the hardest question.
Well, there must be something because fiction writers are in their own circle and you guys have a different logic.
Yeah. Yeah, and, that's true. Yeah. I would say that I tend to look for, I guess the kind of major kind of metrics in my head as I'm looking at a book are, like on the one hand, content, like is this a story that's been told 100 times? Like, do I need to, if I read this book, am I going to really, like, is anything in the book going to surprise me or excite me or interest me?
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So, and like that one, I'm actually pretty forgiving on because there's only so many ways to murder someone, or there's only so many ways people can fall in love. You know, like I love a good twist, but in, like content is really, you know, maybe let's say 40% of it for me. And the other 60% would be like execution. And I think, you know, some of the things that really sets to me a fiction writer apart are this combination of like clarity and specificity, but also, and this is probably not the right word, but it's the best I can come up with is like elegance. And so like, if you think, you know, you can have a scene where, you know, a whole lot of information is conveyed through the sharing of specific details, but without directly stating, you know, maybe the point that the author is trying to get to. And then, you know, you pick up something that's a little bit more workman-y or hacky, and it's, you know, a lot of just declarative sentences. John was angry, you know, John didn't feel worthy. And so I feel like there, you know, and you know, when you get into literary fiction, everything's a lot more complicated. So I'm really speaking more about genre fiction right here. But to me, those are the big kind of things that I look at. I don't know. I mean, when you read for pleasure, you know, Al or Michael, what makes you keep going, or what makes you put a book down?
I think it's the world that the writer creates.
Yeah.
Like a world where you want to be in, even if it's an unpleasant world, you know.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's believable, and if it's not believable, whether it's something that's appealing and insightful. You know, if you, like you were saying, if you, especially with a lot of mystery books, if you pick it up and you feel like you've read it before, or you feel like it's just similar to something else, that doesn't draw you in. But if, especially with characterization and dialogue, you know, if you read like the books that were, forgive me, was it Gregory MacDonald who wrote the Fletch novels?
I don't know those.
Yeah, Chevy Chase did the movie Fletch in the 80s. But
oh, okay, gotcha.
Series of books before that.
Yes.
And so much of it's the dialogue and the sort of sense of humor and the atmosphere. So if when I'm reading, especially dialogue, because if you start, that's where I think a lot of storytelling falls apart for some people. Mm-hmm. It's easy to come up with a plot and, you know, setting and things like that. But when you have to actually define characters and make them believable or sometimes likable or unlikable, if the dialogue isn't getting to you right away, then you kind of tune out. And it's kind of maybe something that happens with later generations, especially from film and television, where you're used to hearing dialogue. So when you read it, you know, you're hearing it in your head. So if it sounds familiar, if it sounds like, you know, it's been done before, kind of tune out. But and that's what I was going to ask you after Al answers your question. I was going to ask you about how, you know, when you're creating these characters in the environments, I noticed that a lot of it's with you is about nature.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. How did that, that's something that would draw me in as a reader. So how did that just, how did you decide to do that yourself and why?
Yeah. That's a great question.
Well, you know, and I was just going to say, for me, the only thing that turns me off in when you get into especially fiction is if you kind of know what's going to happen, be said before mm-hmm. you read it.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And that happens. That just happened to me, I think, about a week ago. And within the first, 15 minutes, you're like, oh, let me guess.
Yeah.
You know exactly yeah. what's going to yeah. happen, yeah. why it's going to happen, and you even know the kind of dialogue they use. They don't even, yeah. there's nothing that, and I don't even want to call it that it's not original. It's just, I guess that's what they mean by saying cliche. It's just mm-hmm. sort of, they say the same sort of, it's like, didn't that happen in the Rockford Files? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
after a while,
you're dating yourself, Al.
Well, well, you know, I get that from Lee. I got that from Lee Goldberg when he said, isn't that just another, it's like all the books coming out. He says, that's just like watching the Rockford Files. And,
yeah.
And I just sort of, it's kind of that way,
Mm-hmm. Well, that happens just, too. If you studied screenwriting at all, if you watch a television show or a movie, screenwriters don't put anything in the story that's not driving the story. So something in the beginning of the story that seems inconsequential is actually something that's important. So you start to plot ahead as if you were the writer, and then you figure mm-hmm. it out. Mm-hmm. It's like you kind of have to remember to just read.
Well, and anyway, so Greg answered that about your nature quest.
Sorry.
No, that's a great, it's a great question. I think, a real turning point as I've continued to try to learn about how to write well. And I mean, that is really like I don't know that anybody really ever masters it. Maybe they do, but for me, it just feels like a real uphill battle every day. But a big turning point though was when I picked up the first book I ever read by Robert McFarlane, who is an English. Mm-hmm. He's an academic actually, but he's also a nature writer, and he writes primarily about England. And it's the first book I picked up was called The Old Ways, and it's about his attempt over about the course of a calendar year to walk various old footpaths in England. And it's also like at the same time like a cultural history of hiking and a cultural history of path making. And it sounds, I think every time I try to explain to someone how like magical this book was, it sounds so boring when I describe it. But I read him and like I was just blown away by the clarity and precision of how he could describe the natural world. And I thought, man, like, I don't even know what kind of tree's in my front yard. And so it was like this real challenge to me. And it was a moment when I also kind of started to internalize maybe a little better that, like, even though there's a lot of ways that kind of the 1970s theories on linguistic theories on how language shapes our ability to see the world and Sapir Whorf and all that stuff, I mean, even though a lot of that isn't really in circulation anymore, like, there is something to be said for our ability to name and the things around us lets us talk about those things. And so so that was a big challenge to me. And I've really tried since I started reading his work to learn as much as I can about the natural world where I set my books. And so sometimes that means in-person trips when possible, but a lot of it is also just kind of reading like conservation magazines and nature guides and stuff like that to try to get a better sense of the place.
Well, it lends a lot of authenticity to it that allows the reader to immerse themselves in that world.
Right. Yeah. Thank you. And I think so in these books I have set in Utah, like I've tried to be very careful so that the wildlife veterinarian, who's one of the two viewpoint characters, has a lot more names for the things around him than the con man, who's a city, like a city boy. Right. And like, when they go out into the mountains, like the city boy, really, he notices like a tree where if it's a chapter from the other point of view, like I'll tell you which tree it is and maybe like why it's in bloom right now or something, you know, so hopefully that also lends itself to like a verisimilitude in the characterization.
That's one of my favorite words. I can't believe that you actually use that.
With the verisimilitude?
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm like, I know it's not real, but I want to make it feel real, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's not just a, you know, throwaway fancy word. It means something, and
yeah,
it's so important to writing.
Yes, agreed. Absolutely.
It means something?
Not like Close Encounters, it means something.
But do you think that fiction writing is better or worse now? Like, how do you think it's gone? Because there's so much of it, so many people doing it.
Yeah.
It's not as special as it used to be. Mm-hmm. So how do you, and I mean, because there's so much of it. With self-publishing and all this stuff. So
yeah,
how do you know what to pick up?
Well, I'll be curious. I'd love to hear both of you kind of respond to that as well. I mean, my original training is as an academic. You know, I went and got a PhD in comparative literature and I wrote a dissertation and all these, you know, lovely published articles about the Spanish Renaissance. And, you know, probably about five people in the whole world have read them. Yeah. And so when I started writing fiction, and I will admit that I still carry some of this, like there's like some internalized contempt for genre fiction and for entertainment fiction that I deal with. Like I really try to like compartmentalize that so that I can do my best work as I'm writing it, you know, and not just sit there and think, oh, this isn't Proust. Oh, this isn't Shakespeare. Oh, this isn't, you know, Saul Bellows. Like, why should I even bother sitting here? So, like, on the one hand, like, I come at it from that angle, and I think, you know, if nothing else, this is a story that might make someone happy, and there's some value in that, and it makes me happy to write it, and I hope, like, that is enough for this thing to merit its own existence. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm personally not too troubled by this kind of flood of production because it's happened, you know, it happened when the printing press was invented. It happened, you know, in the 19th century as, like, paper and ink became drastically cheaper and, like, the, you know, penny dreadfuls started flooding, you know, London. And so, I mean, I think, like, culturally, I'm not real worried about it. Like, personally, it is a little tiresome to wade through so many pieces that I just, for me, are not a good fit, but I tend to just, once I find an author I like, read as much of their stuff as I can because I know I'm gonna like their stuff. So that's just kind of like my, you know, improvised solution to it. So I don't know. I mean, what do you guys think about it, or what have you done to in your own reading practices or reading lives?
I've gone back to really old classics.
Yeah,
me too.
I'm listening to Frankenstein right now.
Ooh, yeah.
And I listen to Dracula. I'm listening to a lot of older stuff because I watch old TV as well. I'm like, I've got either Turner Classic Movies or I've got MeTV on all the time.
Yeah. MeTV, Al. There you go.
That's all. That's just me. That's who I am.
Yeah, that's where you get the Rockford Files these days, right?
Yeah, that's. That's all that's ever going on my TV. Unless,
me too. That's unless what I'm they call going. It that.
Yeah, unless I go for an actual series that I want to see or something or hear about but on Netflix or whatever. But I just look at that, how well their vocabulary was years ago, how differently they spoke because they had such a better knowledge, a better education. And that's sort of what I feel. We're cheapening everything so much. Like, I agree. I'm glad that people can publish and that people can get things out that couldn't maybe before.
Mm-hmm.
That's all good. But I just worry about our quality of English. Even mine, I work at it so hard, and it's terrible when I compare it to what people used to have in their vocabulary. And now I just think that. I think it's getting worse each generation, and it, you know, that's just me. So,
but there's also, I think, what Gregory was talking about a little bit too is, you know, it happened with music and filmmaking and everything else. The more the technology gets accessible, the more people start doing it, the more it sort of becomes more common. And then even though there's a lot of it out there, I think that ultimately allows certain individuals to rise out of that, because that may not have been as easy for them to do so before. When you said that about the, you know, ink and everything becoming more available and that what influence that had, you know, there was an old line that people used to say that the worst thing about the printing press was that it cast doubt on books that couldn't find publishers.
Mm.
Whereas before that, you know, there's sort of this equality, this equal playing field. But once there was people who were willing to publish a book, well, if your book wasn't published, then it must not be good. You know,
right.
There's now anybody can publish anything and do it themselves. And, you know, I work in the book business and I see a lot of self-published books. And I think Al has a point. You know, when the blurbs on the back of the book or the description of the book is there's misspellings in it, or
right.
When you see a writer who uses a lot of exclamation points at the end of every sentence and things,
right.
I have a little twinge where I'm like, you know, this really sucks. And,
but
I think at the same time, you know, a long time ago, I stopped saying that something was bad just because I didn't like it. Now I realize that, you know, it's just not for me. So things that we don't like, you know, hopefully it's filling a void for somebody else. And, and I also think too, that like what Al was saying about watching older things, I'm very much like that. I think everything that I watch is 30 or 40 years old. And I read a lot of older, my favorite book is Don Quixote, which is,
Yeah,
it's not an easy read. So don't like read it casually all the time, but
well, do I have a dissertation for you, sir?
Yeah,
let me just send that right over.
Yeah, I collect those. I have a shelf of Cervantes and stuff from, you know, vintage books and things. And I read a lot of older horror fiction, a lot of Robert Bloch and people like that. Because I think there is something to the idea that maybe I'm a little old fart and I appreciate that language, that style more. But I also think that, you know, there's always going to be a new generation of things, and things have changed. It's not necessarily always for us. And well, I think there is a decline in some, like all you have to do is go on Netflix to see that, you know, anybody can make a movie now. But, you know, there's an opportunity and more encouragement for that one or two people who are really, you know, going to be good to be inspired to go ahead and do it because it is easier.
Yeah, I think that's the good part. But for me, I look at, geez, you know, I'm getting to 60. And when I wish I was at this level when I was in school. I mean that, and I guess I blame my parents. I blame my upbringing, the situation, and not in a bad way. I just look at you were born and raised where you are, and you have what you have available. But I'm trying to get into a lot of the classics, a lot of the things that weren't a part of my young life, and I feel like it's a missed opportunity. And I just see whole generations now that aren't even interested in it.
Well, that's why it's so important to encourage young people to read.
That's right.
Get them while they're young and they'll be vociferous readers.
And, you know, just to build on that, I mean, not only is there something to be said for kind of the quality of the product that we engage with and the kind of decline in that aspect of literature, but one thing that there's a lot of really interesting science about right now is, or research I should say, a lot of interesting research about right now is just how our transition as a culture to visual media and to short, very very short text pieces, tweets in other words, right, or like you know whatever you can fit in a social media burst, is actually, you know, altering a lot of the neural connections or I guess inhibiting the development of the neural pathways that long form reading has built in humans over hundreds of years. And so that has a lot to, unfortunately, has a lot to do with attention span. It has a lot to do with empathy. It has a lot to do with both the ability to concentrate and the ability to problem solve. And so, like, I think regardless of maybe at this point, if we're willing to like cede the battle on quality, there's still something to be said just for encouraging long form reading of any type, because it changes the brain so drastically.
Yeah. Well, and I think, but I think what it is for me is it's setting the goal or the example. Like if it's this way in everything, if all you listen to is Kylie Minogue pop disco, mm-hmm. and you're a musician, that's the epitome. That's kind of the end of it. You know what I'm right. saying? There's right. so much there, and it's, I like Kylie, but but you know, I mean, like, so when I'm writing, yeah. when I was first reading books, of course, they are not at the level they are now. But the thing is, you have to, you know what I'm, I think you get what I'm saying. Like when someone gives me a 5-star review, I think, boy, that's pretty bad.
You mean that they don't have higher standards or what?
Yeah, because I'm thinking, well, God, if this is a 5-star, this is the best nonfiction they've read, then they've got a long way to go. I'm just being honest. I mean, I could be doing a good job with the book with what I have to work with now in my life. But I think a lot of my writing, especially the early writing, is not near what some of the ratings are.
Well, I know what you mean too. It's like you 3 stars might be reasonable, but you want to think that you have room to get better.
Well, yeah, because because I'm thinking if someone writes this whole rating on me, and how what a great written book. That's mm-hmm. maybe proper, but what a well written book he's done, and all this stuff. I just think, wow, you know, it's not that well written. Well, you know, I think that my research is good. There's yeah. don't, like I nonfiction. Yeah, I'll put in the research. I'll meet the people. I'll get all the information as correct as possible, and that's all in there. But learning to write it is something that takes a period of time. So what I was doing years ago compared to what I do now, sure, it's way better now.
Yeah.
But I don't know if that makes sense.
It doesn't.
I'm just being really, really raw and honest here, that because I know you start out at a certain level and you do get better. And so in order for me, I think, to get better, I have to read much better than right. what I can write.
I would agree with that 100%. I agree with that sentiment about, you know, you look back at your previous work and you can see hopefully the gap between what you're producing now and what you previously produced at 100%. I think there's something to be said for, you know, maybe like on the one hand, people who aren't writers or even terribly avid readers tend to have a narrower band, like a narrower range of perception, right, about a text. And so that's not a slam. That's, I think, in the same way that I have a pretty narrow range of perception with painting, you know, like mm-hmm. I'm not a painter. Yeah. Like I know that I like to walk through the St. Louis Art Museum, but like that's about the, like I can identify some movements, but like that's the extent of my response. Like I can't talk about brush techniques or anything like that. So I think that's one part of it. And I think another part is like what's so cool but also so weird about books is like whatever you wrote is only half of it, because whoever reads it makes the other half, and it can be wildly different from what you intended or what you thought you made. Like I've had people tell me about books, my books, and I'm like, boy, in my mind, I never say this out loud, I'm like, I don't remember that book at all. So I mean, you know, even though I understand and I appreciate that honesty of like, maybe you don't feel like it is a 5-star book. I think that's kind of cool that it was a 5-star to someone, you know, like, and that is awesome. That's really cool.
Yeah, I agree with that. I see that. But to me, mm-hmm. from my side of it, so maybe someone that picks up a book once a year and just kind of goes through and, oh yeah, this was good. Wow. I didn't know mm-hmm. that. And they feel good about the book and that filled their need and they're happy. Mm-hmm. that's, I get that, but I just, I look at it and go, God, it was so bad. You know what I mean? Like when you,
I feel that too about my stuff. Yeah.
But you're really hard on yourself too, Al.
I am, because there's a challenge to always get better, because right. I know it's never good enough and it's not the same as what a lot of other people have. I didn't have the same level to start with. So I think that makes me always want to do better. I catch myself in things all the time. So I'm always giving myself heck for it, you know.
But, and Gregory, what you were talking about before too, about the attention span and reading.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is playing a big part of things. People want things in small little boxes now.
Yeah.
And I miss the days when I lived in New York and Chicago where I was taking the train all the time. Because for 45 minutes uninterrupted.
Yeah.
And now I have to drive everywhere. And
don't
have that luxury anymore. And you have to make time to read. And I am, I think, more like you in that sense. I love to read. I could read for hours. But most people don't.
Right. Right.
Yeah. I just wonder too, doesn't that kind of, I think back when you see those old shows in the 60s and 50s and you think how much more time they seem to have in a day to do things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there was less to take their attention, I guess.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but also how they took their time with storytelling too.
Right.
They didn't. That's one of the reasons I like older films and television shows and books, and also one of the reasons I like British television and film, is because they're not so, they don't have to have something happening every 5 minutes to keep you interested and have the slow burn of the story.
Yeah, I like the slow, and you know, and why can't I, you know, I mean, I never have time to be dressed to the nines in a big lounge gown, heels and sparkles, and have my hair all done.
It's because you don't have your priorities in order.
And she answers the door with a big cigarette and has a glass of sherry, and it's only like at 10 in the morning, and she's already. I'm thinking they have so much time. They dress up like that, and everywhere you go, men are wearing suits.
Right.
It's because they don't have Facebook. They don't obsessed with Twitter and.
I guess so, because it just seemed like they had more to do in their life. I don't know. They just can never seem to be getting my gown ready and
get priorities. Al, priorities.
I guess I'm just gonna start fixing my life.
Now, Gregory, before we end this here, I got to make sure that I ask you the single most important question of this interview.
Oh boy!
Which is, did you get a dog?
Yes, he's outside right now because he's been barking. Yes, he is out there, and he is with a beautiful day here in St. Louis, so he's having a great time.
What's his name?
Watson.
Aha. Uh-huh.
It's a little on the nose, I know.
Well, I bring that up for the listeners because it says on your Amazon page that my big goal right now is one day to be responsible enough to get a dog so we can celebrate.
Yes, well, I don't know if I met the criteria I set, but I did get a dog.
Skipped ahead to the dog part.
Yeah, I think I just jumped over that.
Well, that's good, though.
Dogs are good.
Very good.
Yeah, he's a good boy.
Dogs are great. Well, I guess, so now, do you still have your website that people can go to? And
yes, gregoryash.com, and I'm also on Facebook under Gregory Ash. Yeah, and I... You come check me out, see what my next book comes out in a couple weeks. It's a second book in a college academic mystery series. So,
and that's Ash with an E on the end.
That is Ash with an E on the end.
Well, fantastic. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.